Chapter 17, Parables of Joan. When you're a preacher's kid, you tend to see things biblically. Even if you grow up to be a non-believer, you can't escape your influences, the drip, drip, drip of Sunday school into a malleable young brain. And as a non-believer, I don't wish to. With apologies to my Christian friends, the riot and richness of Bible lore might even be better appreciated straight, without the addition of religious intoxicants. The narrative stuff seems to travel best. Genesis is packed with wonder, horror, and perversion. Exodus is a screenplay. Cecil B. DeMille's epic The Ten Commandments still runs on ABC every Easter weekend and has surely had a greater impact on the North American public than its scriptural inspiration. DeMille was able to pare away the oddities of the Book of Exodus and get right to the crowd scenes and special effects. If you're interested in the oddities, check out Exodus 4:18-31, the Bridegroom of Blood verses, among the most puzzling of biblical headshakers. Kings tells of heroism, power, and corruption. Job is a strange, magnificent outlier, a portrait of a bored and perverse god toying with the human anthill like a kid with a magnifying glass. Other books are neither narrative nor particularly edifying. If you want a rebuttal to all this wonder and magic of the Bible stuff, try Leviticus. Much of it reads like a medical text written by post-apocalyptic hillbillies. Then there are the many non-narrative books of poetry, anguish, philosophy, and song. Ecclesiastes, the Song of Solomon, Psalms, Proverbs, and in the Gospels, the parables of Jesus. The instructive and often mystifying tales of Jesus are inextricably woven into Western popular culture and language. Thanks to Jesus, the curse of a prodigal son became a blessing. There must have been plenty of bad Samaritans back in the day, but now, thanks to Jesus, no such thing. The intended lessons are not always clear. Some of the apparently straightforward metaphors of Jesus can, on closer examination, become puzzling. The parable of the mustard seed has long been argued over without any theological consensus emerging. But there's always a message in there somewhere. Every parable must have its point. Good literature, though, should never be didactic. Somerset Maugham believed every well-told story of human behavior would naturally prove instructive. No need for the author to slather some edifying moral on top like wheatgrass icing on a birthday cake. This book is neither popular fiction nor religious text. There's money to be made in both fields, but I lack the imagination for one and the paranoid zeal for the other. Whereas the Bible mixes history and legend and literature seeks truth in fiction, this is the story of a woman and her family. It's a personal history, reconstructed through memory, augmented by the minimum necessary amount of speculation. The goal is to describe a character, a strong and admirable soul whose influence lifted almost everyone she knew. There's a credibility issue here. A man writing about his mother might be expected to embellish. Who's to say this chronicle is not just a variation on the golf career of Kim Jong-il? Back in 1994, North Korean media reported that the dear leader had played golf for the first time on a par 72 course in Pyongyang. According to the official news story, Kim Jong-il picked it up quickly. He scored 5 holes in one and shot 34 for 18 holes. That's a nifty 38 under par. His golf buddies must have owed dear leader free beers amounting to 40% of North Korean GDP. Quite a guy, that Kim Jong-il. By contrast, I can swear by the sacred couch of Oprah that my tale is true, and my case is helped by the modesty of my claims. My mother could not have scored a 34 in miniature golf, nor was she a particularly marketable biographical subject, a reformed crack whore, or a folksy ex-governor. She was simply a woman who overcame and triumphed. A history exceptional in its own way, but in most of its details, thoroughly mundane. So the tale of Joan Burgess is not too big a stretch. All the same, it cannot rest purely on personal opinion. Much better to rely on incident and, where possible, outside perspectives. When telling the story of a life, there ought to be parables. Telling a loved one's tale often comes down to anecdotes remembered and collected. Comprehensive histories, even of our most beloved, are not possible. As memoirists sometimes say, we are not born with tape recorders up our asses. We have to make do. If we don't remember every crucial moment and every precious conversation, we search for meaning in the material we have. And while secular histories must have narrative chapters, parables have their place as well. Like DNA can be extracted from a strand of hair, character can be revealed by small events. So we tell the small stories we remember, sometimes mundane, and hope the details will reveal larger truths. This first parable of Joan is not of the mundane variety. One summer, Mum was commuting back and forth from our family cottage in Clear Lake, Manitoba, to her teaching job at the Assiniboine Community College. Dad was already on holidays and at the lake full-time, so Mum was joining in as best she could, making the 75-mile drive back to Brandon every day. Out on the road one morning, she saw they'd forgotten to fill the tank. She was worried. It was too early in the morning for most gas stations on this lonely highway. Halfway to Brandon, at the town of Minnedosa, she was relieved to see the Esso station had just opened and pulled in. After paying the sleepy attendant, she came back out to the car and climbed in. Two men popped up in the back seat. "Drive, lady," one said. "Don't fuck around or we'll kill you and take the car." Mum looked toward the station. The kid was nowhere in sight. She cursed herself for not chatting, perhaps getting an oil check or a windshield cleaning. One of the men stretched out, throwing his legs over the passenger seat. The man sitting behind her draped his arm over her shoulder. The car reeked of exhaled booze. On their instructions, she turned south on Highway 10, heading toward Brandon. In the early summer morning, they had the road to themselves. On most such mornings, it was a familiar and relaxing drive. They were ex-cons, the prefix having been added very recently, and natives from a nearby reserve. "Which reserve are you boys from?" Mum asked. She had taught enough native students over the years to know something about the local map, enough to make chit-chat. She was intent on establishing a tone, steering the mood away from threatening or worse. She spoke calmly, asked simple questions, and slowly but steadily accelerated. The speed limit on the two-lane, gently winding highway was 60 miles per hour. Mum brought the Volkswagen Rabbit up to 70, then 75 miles per hour. She'd never had a speeding ticket in her life. It was Mum's sincere hope that her first one would be written up any moment. Right about now would be good, thanks, officers. Meanwhile, her two passengers were bickering. It seemed there was a third musketeer, a buddy still behind bars. Porthos and Aramis were arguing about whether they ought to break him out, a project that might involve this vehicle in some yet-to-be-determined way. Or they might just go drinking. Their plans seemed a little unfocused. Mum let them argue as she searched the horizon for signs of the cavalry. On weekends, Highway 10 is full of young holidaymakers, some in a little too much of a hurry to start relaxing. For that reason, it is also frequently dotted with speed traps. But it was early, and a weekday. Police officers, fishermen, and grizzly bears all understand that there is no point going down to the river if the salmon aren't running. Not a single cop was on the road. Roadside billboards concealed nothing but tall grass. The Trans-Canada Highway marks the northern city limit of Brandon. Thanks to Mum's expeditious driving, it was approaching quickly. The call of that wide east-west thoroughfare seemed to have its effect on the two hijackers. They started to talk about the attractions of Winnipeg, the big city 2 hours' drive to the east. More bars, more pals, more opportunities for profitable misbehavior. Apparently their incarcerated accomplice would have to wait for his big bust out. The boys had decided to go east. Throughout the drive, Mum had worked cautiously to put a different spin on the circumstances, subtly establishing a different storyline. This was not a hijacking, but a lift, willingly granted to two itinerant gentlemen seeking new prospects. Now that Brandon was in view, it was only natural that she continue on to her job while they turned left to find their destinies. "I'm going to go on into the school now, boys," she explained. "You should be able to find a ride to Winnipeg without much trouble." Turning onto Highway 1, she pulled the car over. She held her breath as the two men piled out of the back seat. The door had barely clicked shut when she was spinning shoulder gravel, the little red rabbit running as though from the shadow of a hawk. Then she went to work and taught classes all day. A domestic parable now. When Joan was young and living in Bassano, her parents had taken in the orphaned Ada. It may have been one of the very few maternal examples Joan decided to follow. In the mid-70s, we gained two new siblings at 54 Clement. Nancy was one of Leslie's best friends. A red-haired eccentric, Nancy was the kind of girl whose personal style might take her from small-town ridicule to a career in fashion or design. The kind of girl whose outsized personality and relentless truth-telling managed to be both exhilarating and scary, like a motorcycle with bad brakes. Nancy's equilibrium would soon be tested in the worst way. When she was about 15, her mother died suddenly of a brain aneurysm. Within a year, her father had been killed in a car accident. Suddenly, Nancy was an orphan. So, for the next 2 years, she came to live with us. Many years later, Nancy still found it hard to mention my mother's name without choking up. She told me she once burst into tears upon seeing some hotel sheets with the same pattern as the ones at our house. Some of those tears would be for her lost parents, certainly, but some of them, surely, were gratitude. The other new arrival came to us through less tragic circumstances. Ron F. was Al C.'s old friend from those long-ago school days. I had since become buddies with both Ron and his older brother Gord. They lived a few blocks away. Their mother, as I mentioned earlier, was a free spirit who had separated from her hockey-playing husband. We used to go over there a lot. Gord painted his bedroom black and covered the light fixtures with tinfoil. We listened to Deep Purple, really loud. Mrs. F., upstairs with her boyfriend, didn't seem to mind. It was a very laissez-faire environment. Gord and Ron both had long delinquent histories. Ron had been one of our little break-in gang, and Gord would eventually do a 3-month stretch in Brandon jail for drug dealing. We smuggled him joints during visiting hours. Shortly after his release, the RCMP raided his apartment and found that hash pipe of mine. Happily, I never did time. One day, Mrs. F. announced that she was moving to Winnipeg, taking her two youngest children with her. Ron and Gord would stay in Brandon with their father. Very quickly, that wasn't working out. Mr. F. wasn't interested in having the boys around the trailer. Nancy was already living with our family. I knew there was precedent, so I asked my parents if Ron and Gord could stay with us. Mum and Dad sat down with Ron and Gord and laid out the rules. No late weeknights, no drugs or alcohol in the house, meals with the family, room and board to be paid by Mr. F. Gord lasted about 3 weeks. I liked Gord. He was a carefree Philistine, a cheerfully amoral, good-time Charlie. But he was apparently incapable of viewing authority figures, even well-meaning ones, with anything other than suspicion. Gord would skulk in the back door and disappear into the basement, rarely showing up for meals. My parents quickly grew tired of it, and Gord was asked to find other accommodations. Ron was different. He showed up for meals. He referred to my parents as Mr. Burgess and Mrs. Burgess. He never spoke about them to me with anything other than respect. Ron went to school, obeyed the rules. I was taken aback. He and I were still partying together at every chance. Having a buddy as a housemate was great that way. But Ron was more careful than I was about keeping the house rules, for obvious reasons. And he liked it there. In hindsight, Ron was getting traction on a different road. Eventually, he would identify an affinity for math and calculation and begin a career at Revenue Canada. Not everyone's idea of a happy ending, but years earlier, hanging around in that room with the smoke and the black walls and the deep purple, it's about the last thing I would have expected. My mother cannot be given the credit for things that Ron accomplished on his own initiative, but seeing the way he reacted to my mother was a lesson and a reminder of what little miracles her influence and quiet example could achieve. A popular subset of the parables of Joan are the rescue tales. These were the occasions on which Mum's veritable spidey sense for the emotional distress of loved ones led to decisive action, or in some cases, an almost zen-like inaction. I was in Winnipeg for a week of training, Dad says. As part of pastoral counseling, we made a lot of hospital visits, and the training was intended to help us understand medical procedures. In the morning, we watched an autopsy. Later that day, we watched an operation from the gallery. It involved a spinal tap with one of those huge needles inserted into the base of the spine. The surgeon pulled the needle out, and I remember seeing the way the skin puckered up. Then I started to feel faint, and I had to sit down. Shortly afterward, he called home just to check in. Mum heard the tone of his voice, hung up the phone, jumped in the car, made the 2-hour drive into Winnipeg, and took him home. It wasn't the only time. She once jumped into a car and drove 3 hours to Fort Qu'Appelle, Saskatchewan after hearing the weariness in his voice following a long and stressful encounter group. As of the late 70s, my parents were still attending and even running a lot of those. One memorable event was held in Winnipeg. Both my parents attended. The group included a young participant in rough shape. His own mother had died after a long illness, during which his father had not behaved well, carrying on flagrantly with a girlfriend. Now the young man was filled with rage. That rage needed a target. Somehow, that target became Dad. "I think you're a chicken shit," the young man snarled at him. "Well," the group facilitator said brightly, "perhaps you need to work this out with a pillow fight." "He would sort of wave the pillow at me," Dad says, "and then behind the pillow, he would punch me in the face." The 70s were a stupid time. Out-of-town participants were all sleeping in the same room on mattresses. In the middle of the night, Joan sneaked over to my mattress, Dad says, to comfort me. Fade to black. Faster, please. The 70s, it is often said, were still the 60s for a stretch. Those of us too young to fully participate in the actual calendar 60s were intent on prolonging that decade till we could get our taste of it. Hitchhiking was part of that. The romantic call of the road was still drawing lines of kids out to Highway 1. My friends and I would all eventually join the queues, spending summer wages on Western adventures through the Rockies and on to the Okanagan Valley in Vancouver. But my brother Jock went first. At Easter break of his grade 10 year, he convinced Mum and Dad that he could safely hitchhike to Regina to visit his childhood best friend. He had reached the town of Whitewood, roughly halfway, when darkness fell. There he stood as night closed in, and all the helpful travelers apparently retired for the night. When a car full of fun-loving locals threw a beer bottle that narrowly missed his head, he decided it would be better to wait inside the Esso Station Cafe. "I spent the next miserable 9 hours with a cup of coffee perched in front of me," Jock says. "The waitress kindly informed me about 7 times that I would have to leave if I fell asleep, so I had to keep my wretched head propped up the whole time." He had set out from Brandon a ramblin' man, but by 6 a.m., the spirit of wanderlust so essential to the music of Woody Guthrie had gone all squishy. Jock was rambled out. He made the walk of shame to the payphone and placed a collect call. "Mum answered the phone almost immediately," he says. "My next memory is of sitting out front and seeing the white Acadian turning in off the highway with Mum's red hair visible behind the wheel. She had not a single word of reproach for me. She just seemed genuinely happy to see me." Many of Mum's character traits seemed to have been formed in opposition to those of her own mother. Grandma had been a viciously competitive bridge player. Mum could not be coaxed to sit at a card table. It was a breakthrough one Christmas when we played a few pleasant Scrabble games. When it came to meddling, Grandma was a ninja. Coercion, pressure, emotional manipulation. That was parenting, pretty much. Thus, Mum would sooner have her fingernails pulled out with hot tongs than stick her nose where it wasn't wanted. The meddling mother caricature, so central to cartoons, domestic drama, and Jewish comedians' stand-up routines, was, for us, just that, a stock image, like Snidely Whiplash. Our mother, you had to beg to meddle. "One of the things that was strongest for me was that Mum did not insert herself," Joe says. "In high school and after, there were periods where I was so depressed that I would sit there and listen to sad music. I dreaded leaving the house. She would just be with me, bringing me coffee. In my freshman year at University of Winnipeg, Mum and Dad would trek into Winnipeg to see me, Mum leading that charge, of course. Again, I was really depressed. We would sit there in a restaurant for an hour and I would say absolutely nothing. Dad would try to get me talking. Mum was quiet and would restrain Dad at times, but I also know that she was suffering right along with me." Even when Mum knew that intervention was required, she possessed the subtlety of a Deng Xiaoping. There were occasions when, sensing something amiss with one of her children, she directed Dad to stay up late. "Don't ask about it," she would caution. "Just stay up and wait." Mum knew the explanation would come easier in her absence. When it did, she would slip out of bed to join the conversation, and to prove once again that where she had received judgment, her own children would be offered support, love, and wisdom. That facility for empathy and understanding could show up at very unexpected moments. One afternoon when I was about 12, Mum was sitting on the living room couch chatting with a friend while I stood at the front door trying to get her attention. It wasn't working. Bursting with impatience and spurned entitlement, I pulled a handful of change from my pocket and flung it across the room to where they sat. The coins went rat-a-tat-tat off the living room wall, just missing the startled couch sitters. I braced myself. But Mum simply fixed me with a quizzical gaze. "You really need people to listen to you, don't you?" she asked. It was not a rebuke. It was an observation, delivered as if by a film critic identifying a motif in a Bergman film. I stood there, ashamed and humbled. I can't remember what I had wanted to ask. Parenting, like dodging bullets, is an existential activity. It happens in real time. Only in retrospect do you see the astounding variety of topics and situations a parent must handle. Even as I struggle to recall little bits of precious conversation my mother and I shared, gentle jokes, serious subjects, I'm often reminded of the vast, random banquet of advice and information she was called upon to supply. In grade 9, I attended Rivers Collegiate, where Mum was teaching. "Steve," she told me one evening, "when I was standing beside you in the hall today, I noticed that you need to start using antiperspirant." Another puberty-related curveball, and a deceptively tricky one. There are plenty of young men who get it wrong. Some opt for deodorant first, then shower, or shirt first, then deodorant, or, most pernicious of all, deodorant, more deodorant, shirt, deodorant on shirt, and finally, enough cologne to cater a hobo reunion. Antiperspirant in hand, I had a question. "Mom, where are the sweat glands? On the hairy part of the armpit, or below it?" She thought a moment. "It's the hairy part, I think," she said. Of course, she was right. Whether in the realm of fact or opinion, Mum could be depended upon to steer her children right. One day when I was in grade 3 or 4, I asked her to give me a bowl cut. What I really wanted was a beetle cut, but I had misunderstood the terminology. Think of it. A harried mother of 5, pressed for any break she can get, and here comes a sucker, volunteering to be sheared like a sheep. 30 seconds, with scissors and mixing bowl, and for once she might get a spare moment to flop on the living room couch with a cup of instant. But no. "I don't think you really want a bowl cut, Steve," she explained. I believe that incident alone marks my mother as a creature more elevated than ordinary humans. Mum didn't share that assessment. In fact, that kind of thinking could make her impatient. Someone singing her praises, as we kids often did later in life, would almost certainly annoy her. It's not that she considered herself a bad person, but she was painfully aware of her own shortcomings, and our lavish tributes rang false to her. I believe she found them dehumanizing. Among the worst offenders was her brother Stan. He had a habit of composing hymns of praise that made his sister cringe. During one of his visits, we were all at the dinner table, enjoying one of Stan's buffed and polished tales from his stock theater days. Mum stood behind him, carrying a casserole dish hot from the oven. She wanted to put it on the table. The oven mitts were reaching the limits of their heat-shielding capacity, but Stan rolled on through his anecdote, unaware. Finally, Mum got the dish down on the table. Stan reached out to help himself and recoiled. "Good Lord, that's hot!" Delighted, he turned his gaze on Mum. She stood there, holding that scalding pot while I prattled on. She wouldn't say, "Excuse me, hot pot coming through." She just stood there, burning up, and waited. It was a good story. Our mother was indeed a stoic individual, as her brother gleefully pointed out. But Mum was pissed. Not just modest or embarrassed by the attention, she was genuinely irked. "Stan," she said, "it was not like that." Her annoyance surprised me, What was it about Stan's reaction that had upset her so? "He likes to paint this picture of me," she said, "suffering quietly." It was the suggestion of passivity, of resignation, that angered her. Joan Burgess would have you know that she was no martyr. The woman who would survive medical malpractice and enough chronic conditions to kill a stable of horses was nothing if not tough. Respect, please. Chapter 18, Endgame. The flat farmland west of Winnipeg is still showing early March snow as I drive toward the wide band of sunset. Leslie's in the passenger seat. The rental car is hers. I made a point of booking the same flight as my sister. 7 months earlier, on this exact stretch of highway, a sleeping Greyhound bus passenger had been decapitated by his deranged seatmate. It's not as though I was really worried about how a fight over the armrest might escalate in this part of the world. I just didn't want to pass up the chance to catch a ride. I'm speeding, in hopes of getting to the hospital before they lock the doors for the night. Leslie and I spend the drive in conversation, trying on and testing the various options: hope, despair, fatalism, resignation. "Has Uncle Stan called?" Leslie asks. I'm momentarily speechless. "Les," I say, "Stan died a few days ago." It's an honest oversight. I almost missed the news myself, buried deep in one of Dad's emailed news updates. Mum's older brother had been in failing health for a while and died after a brief hospitalization. Any other week, it would have been a full-page headline in our family. As it was, our favorite uncle had been reduced to the status of a barkay. 4 members of that excellent R&B outfit were killed December 10, 1967, in a Wisconsin plane crash, but the headlines were all about soul man Otis Redding. For our cousins, of course, their father played Otis. My mother, just a rhythm guitarist. Here was a small silver lining, at least. Mum had slipped into a steady unconsciousness before news of her brother's death arrived. Lynn had arrived in Brandon first, as usual. She and Dad take turns keeping vigil, not wanting to leave Mum alone for a moment. Around the corner from Mum's room in the palliative care ward is a large common room for families and nurses. There's a kitchen and tables, a big screen TV, and budgies. One evening, as Lynn is sipping coffee and watching the birds, one blue, one green, one white, hop and squawk in their corner cage, a nurse arrives to replace their feed. "Their names are Fiona, Shrek, and Patience," the nurse explains. "Actually, the blue one is new, Fiona the second. The first Fiona got pecked to death. We got a ringer. Don't tell the patients, they have no idea." The nurse sits down at Lynn's table. "I'm the one who called you. I thought you guys needed to know the situation. I knew your mom. She taught me at Assiniboine Community College. Your mom was a role model for a lot of those young students. We always knew when she was coming down the hall. We could hear her shoes coming click, click, click. She always wore lovely shoes. Such grace and dignity." Leslie and I reach the hospital in time to get upstairs. Jock has already arrived in Brandon. Joe is scrambling to arrange his affairs in California. Lynn is in the hospital room when we walk in. She looks like 40 miles of bad road. But I know there are worse sights coming. Mum is on the bed, lying on her side in a blue-green hospital gown, eyes closed. Her white hair is a bright halo under the fluorescent light at the head of the bed. Her face seems changed. Then I notice her teeth are out. It makes quite a difference. Left at last with no more control over her own appearance, she looks more like her mother. A plastic oxygen mask is strapped to her face. Lynn and Jock have been warning us to prepare for a shock. Not the sight of her, but the sound. Her breath is rasping like a rusty saw blade. Every intake of air shows its muscular effort, as though she were rhythmically lifting weights. It's too violent. It's not sustainable. And sometimes it gets even worse, louder and more erratic, causing panic episodes in whomever happens to be in the room. As bad as things have been from time to time over the past year or two, this is different. This looks like endgame. We've been told that Mum has double pneumonia, often the final compassionate bullet that finishes a slow death. Not that we're all agreed about whether we've reached that point. Mum is still getting antibiotics, and Lynn, at least, is still armored for battle. There is to be no surrender. Mum can still pull through. Now that reinforcements have arrived, it is time to organize deployment. I'm a night owl by nature. It makes sense that I should pull the overnight shift. There's a mattress and some bedding on the floor and a TV at the foot of Mum's bed. Our evenings are set. I click through the programming guide, looking for something. Score! Way up the dial in the 60s. RoboCop. I look over at the bed. Let's give it another try, Mum. You'll like it better this time. About 20 years earlier, in the waning days of the Reagan administration, I had dragged my parents to a Winnipeg theater to see the new sci-fi epic from director Paul Verhoeven. There's more to it than you think, I swore. Later, over dinner, I was forced to apologize. Apparently the nuances had escaped them. Now I'm betting that deep inside her oxygenated limbo, Mum is safely removed from the obnoxious intrusion of RoboCop and prating nurses and every other worldly annoyance. But is she? It's the water cooler topic of the week. Sometimes, Mum's eyelids flicker. Occasionally they drift open, though her eyes, when they briefly appear, do not move. What does it mean? Nothing, I say. Lynn disagrees. Each flicker might be a response to some stimulus that has registered in her still-functioning brain. See, Lynn says, I just said Dad's name, and her eyebrows moved. False hope, I argue. A little Burgess family replay of the Terry Schiavo case. People in vegetative states are not usually inert. They move, open their eyes, make sounds, all signifying nothing more than the running of a headless chicken. Meaningless nerve storms. Except when it means something. Medical history is full of stories of coma patients awakening, and even describing conversations held by their bedsides. Mum was a veteran of countless medical crises. Lynn and Jock had sat by her bed when she had not known them. She had swallowed her own wedding ring, yet returned to herself. Time and again she had beaten the doomsayers, like Muhammad Ali rope-a-doping George Foreman. Vegas odds makers would be leery of betting against her at this point. So I am playing along with Lynn's theory just in case. Periodically, I wind up Mum's old music box. It's a treasured heirloom that lulled us to sleep as children, playing the three little melodies whose names we never knew, even as the notes were engraved on our little psyches like a Burgess subdivision of the collective unconscious. I sing to her as well, standards like Daybreak, which Mum once told me she bought on a Blue Jay 78 back in the 30s. But mostly, I sing Loch Lomond. That sentimental Scottish tune was played at her beloved father's funeral, piper and all. Years ago at a Robbie Burns dinner, I'd asked someone to teach me a few verses so that I could do a little better than just parroting the "You take the high road and I'll take the low road" chorus. It's coming in handy now. I imagine Mum is impressed. Or not. During one of my overnight vigils, I accidentally knock over a bedside vase. It bounces off the table, the wall, and the floor, clattering like a fire alarm. Mum doesn't even flinch. I keep singing to her anyway. Sometimes Mum's breathing changes. This causes a flurry of activity, particularly from my two sisters. Everyone braces for the big moment, but there are plenty of false alarms. One evening, I'm heading to the grocery store to buy provisions for a communal family meal at the hospital. My cell phone rings. It's Lynn. You need to come now, she urges. Mum sounds bad. If you don't start now, you could be too late. When I arrive, Mum is resting comfortably. I try to hide my impatience. Variations on the scene have played out several times. My sisters hover over Mum, alert to every alteration. They tear up at every change in breathing. And me? Not so much. Watching their hair trigger reactions, I'm fighting annoyance. But why? Our mother is dying, I know that. Maybe they're jumping the gun today. They'll be right soon enough. I'm embarrassed by my own moods, by my suppressed exasperation. Where does it come from? I suppose I just think there's no need to get worked up over and over again about the inevitable. Perhaps I'm not ready to grieve. Once we get started, we might dissolve in a helpless mess. I want to function, to be strong for what's coming. Perhaps I'm just trying to ignore the abyss and resent my sisters for staring into it. Then again, perhaps I'm grieving already. Who is the form on the hospital bed, mute but for her frightening breath? My sisters see their mother, a woman who is struggling, possibly in pain. Their tears express their love and empathy. I see a woman who is already gone, whose final quietus will be a formality. I'm waiting. Perhaps my emotions are as well. This is the flip side of first-time parenthood. There are no lessons, just the examples of friends who have been there first. My friends Matthew and Laura have both suffered the untimely loss of their mothers by means respectively cruel and slow and cruel and sudden. Early-onset Alzheimer's stripped Mrs. Mallon of her characteristic dignity and reserve, her faculties, her personality, and only then took her life. Laura's mother, still in her 40s, taken away by a drunk, vibrant and alive one day, vanished the next, leaving Laura with only a helpless rage, paid off with a paltry jail term for the drunk. Both my friends struggled with their loss. Months after the death of Laura's mum, she dreamed they were walking together, talking, enjoying each other's company. "Mum," Laura asked, "are you really dead?" "Yes," her mother replied, "I am." For the moment, our mother is here. But a turning point has come. The medical team is suggesting that Mum's antibiotics be stopped. A difficult call for anyone, and for us, there's that added complication. The recommendation comes from Dr. Molecule. Our reflex reactions to his suggestions are almost hardwired by now. Molecule says zig, Burgess says promptly zag. But we've also been told that the drugs may be interfering with Mum's breathing. Even if she is breathing her last, we want that to be easier. And at this point, it has become clear to all that the time has come. Let nature sweep all before it. The antibiotics are stopped. Taking the night watch is more anxious now. I sit beside the bed, hold her hand, and pretend that the late-night TV shows are a shared experience. Her breathing seems unchanged through the night. I turn in around 4 a.m., awakened mid-morning by Lynn and Les. Mum is still there, chugging away like a diesel generator. One tough customer. There's a routine to my post-vigil mornings, a little breakfast at the hospital, then off to Forbidden Flavors Coffee and Ice Cream Shop for a double espresso, and at last a shower and shave back at River Heights Terrace. Those espressos are heaven-sent. At the cafe, I'm hailed by a high school acquaintance. I haven't seen Brian in decades. It tends to happen on these visits. "You're on the coast now, right?" Brian asks. "A lot of people out there. Ever run into D? He messed himself up pretty good. Wrecked that Corvette of his. Had to get new knees and a hip replacement, too." I hear my name again. The cafe manager is scanning the room, waving a cordless phone. "Is Steve Burgess here?" I realize simultaneously that my cell phone is off and that I'm very predictable. I take the phone. It's Leslie. "Mum's gone," she says. No one is crying when I walk into the hospital room, but their eyes suggest it's a temporary lull. Mum is lying with her face turned sideways. Her skin hangs down over her open jaw like a flat tire over a bicycle rim. Actors can't really play dead. You just can't make your muscles sag like that. It's not as though Mum looked great last night, and yet the difference is a shock. She's dead. There's no holding it now, thank goodness. I sit beside the bed and cry. The end, they tell me, was quick. Jock had just left the room when Les ran to catch him. Mum's breathing was intermittent. Jock barely made it back into the room in time. Dad, meanwhile, had gone the other way. "He just stood up without a word," Lynn tells me, as if there was something he'd forgotten in the next room, and headed straight out the door. Moments later, Lynn found him in the hallway. He looked at her like a lost little boy staring up at a cop. "Is she gone?" he asked. There was nothing painful about it, as far as any observer could tell. She simply stopped. That indomitable little engine, that dogged pump with over 80 years of faithful service, has gone still. For the first time in her children's lives, we are divided from our mother by something other than mere physical space. The next couple of hours are both vague and somehow vivid. A mist covers all of it now, some protective reflex of forgetfulness. Leslie says that she doesn't recall phoning me at the cafe. And although I remember the hours we spend sitting around the hospital room, talking, Mom still on the bed behind us, I can't remember a single specific topic. But there's laughter. We're telling family stories. Every once in a while, I look over my shoulder at Mom, still on the bed, head turned, lifeless. Yet now, more than before, it seems somehow that we are there together. It feels like a gathering at the end of a long mountain hike. Weariness, and yet, with some sort of balm descending over all. Reverend David Cathcart, minister at Knox United, drops by to pay his respects. She was revered, he says simply. It's quite a while before they arrive to take Mom away. I quickly wish I'd been absent. The nurses roll the body onto its back, and now Mom's eyes and mouth fall open in a ghastly, vapid gape. It's no wonder we strive to separate body and soul in the face of death. If we did not, the sights we see might seem proof of lasting agony and torment. That night, we gather at a steakhouse. Dad has a little trouble with the remnants of his salad and starts eating it with his hands. We're all over him. This is the sort of necessary nagging that has been neglected over the past year or so. It's our responsibility now. The new era is beginning. After dinner, one carload heads back to River Heights, but Dad decides to join me across the street at Forbidden Flavors for a coffee. He wants to talk. The tables around us are full of laughing chatter as we sip our coffee. I wasn't always a good husband to her, Dad says. I was focused on my own needs. I didn't pay attention to what she was going through. I would come home and want to make love, but she would be at the end of a day battling with 5 kids and everything else. It was a very intense relationship right from the start. It was a very sexual relationship. She used to tell me, "You're only interested in my body." I have frozen myself into an attitude of receptive attention. I'm wishing there was a mirror somewhere in my line of sight so I could check my face for signs of panic. Of course, I must have understood all this stuff on some level. 5 kids suggests at least some degree of familiarity and physical closeness, and I'm touched and flattered to know that in his most grievous hour, my father is opening his heart to me. But it's an unexpected honor. A guy ought to be given a warning that this kind of honor is about to be sprung. A deer on the highway should expect headlights too, but they almost never do. They just freeze and stare and nod. I assume they nod anyway. I did. "You learned and did your best, Dad," I tell him. "You guys had the kind of relationship most couples never achieve. You had a wonderful retirement." "We had a great time together. You know, in a lot of ways, that phase was the best time of our whole relationship. We really became closer than ever." She told me how lucky she felt, I agree. Now I am getting the terrible feeling that the happy retirement and sexual relationship themes are about to merge. I brace myself. But to my selfish relief, the moment passes, we step back from the brink and sideways into fond remembrances, lingering to tell stories in the cheerful cafe. Soon I must drive Dad home to River Heights. He has spent many nights by himself in the 2-bedroom apartment, and tonight there will be people there to keep him company. But tonight, for the first time, Dad is alone in the most profound sense. Many times in the past, we adult children had played that morbid guessing game. Who will go first, and who will be left behind? Most of us thought it would work out differently. Dad must have thought so, too. It's unlikely he ever gave much thought to a night like this. Whatever other purpose they serve, funeral services keep people busy. Relatives are flying in, nieces and nephews and a couple of cousins I've never met, and people planning their contributions. Everyone is taking turns going through old photo books to choose snapshots for a big cardboard display. It's as self-defeating as trying to count salted peanuts. Particular photos lead to stories, expressions of admiration for particular phases of Mum's ever-evolving look, questions about bit players and extras. The goal is forgotten, restated, and lost again in some new reverie. There's one last chance to see Mum. She's laid out at the funeral parlor, looking very natural. No heavy makeup. The morticians have done such a nice job that I begin to feel aggrieved on behalf of a profession that now seems to me unfairly maligned. As we leave, it's a little shocking to recall that there will be no more sightings of this physical form. This was not a preparation for public viewing. It was just for us, perhaps to remove the memory of that last hospital image. Mum's next stop is not a casket. The service is held at Knox United. The family enters the church as the attendees sing Lord of the Dance. On the podium beside the pulpit stands a tall, plain wooden box holding Mum's ashes. There are two pictures, a recent portrait and the old 1945 picture Dad used to moon over during their separation. Beside the box is the Christmas trophy, adorned with the two Highland dancers. Say what you like, Moses, but there's a place for graven images. Mum always wanted a pleasant sort of reception, a little wine and cheese affair. We hold it across the street at Brandon University. It goes well. A congenial celebration with some long-lost faces reappearing to shake hands and reminisce. Afterward, we haul the flowers out to the car, some to keep, some to drop off at the homes of friends. It's not enough, though. Too much like real life, like the hospital and River Heights Terrace, where death is delivered like newspapers. Not enough like Romeo and Juliet, where the entire audience is joined in weeping for the enormity of loss. I suppose I never expected the heavens to open, the papers to call, banks to close, and the mayor to announce a special day while fighting back tears. Still, we got one more shot at it. Dad's a pretty popular guy.